Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Terrascope podcast. My name is Kyle Hardcastle, and I'm the Director of Intelligence for Terrascope, and your host throughout this podcast series, where we explore the terrorist threat, recent incidents, and protective security considerations. In this episode, we are going to discuss the recent conviction of a 16-year-old boy in the UK for terrorism offences, who, among other things, was planning to attack people he believed had insulted Islam, with the investigation establishing that he had researched the Isle of Wight Music Festival as a potential target. To help navigate this topic, I'm delighted to be joined by Russ Phillips. Russ is an event risk management specialist and hostile vehicle mitigation subject matter expert. Having completed a 30-year career in policing, 18 of which were in counter-terrorism, he created his own company, Island Site Protective, before joining CrowdGuard as their risk and counter-terrorism director. Russ's portfolio of experience relating to risk assessment, risk mitigation, and hostile vehicle mitigations includes major events such as the wedding of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, the death of Her Majesty the Queen, G7, and COP26. As well as major sporting events, including the Wimbledon Championships and FIFA Euros 2021. So Russ, welcome to the Terrascope podcast.
Thanks, Carl. That's a nice introduction.
So I know you're an extremely busy man, and it's great to have you with us today, as I'm aware that the topics we're going to be covering and touching upon in this episode are of great interest to our listeners, because we've actually received quite a few email requests relating to the areas we're going to be covering. But before we get into talking about this recent conviction, the plot against the Isle of Wight Music Festival, as with all our guests, would you be so kind as to share a little bit about yourself, your experience, and how you came to work in counter-terrorism and hostile vehicle mitigation?
Yes, of course. As you say, I did 30 years with Sussex Police, joined as a 22-year-old first. Part of that was the same as most people, a bit of response work, a bit of uniform work, that sort of thing. Became a search advisor, pulser, and started looking for IEDs and that kind of thing. The search side of thing was really interesting. Started to learn about terrorist methods of attack and that kind of thing. And as I say, got very interested in the terrorism search side. Parallel to that, Sussex Police used to own the National Barrier Asset, the NBA, that big collection of hostile vehicle mitigation, temporary hostile vehicle mitigation products that are deployed all over the UK for major events. Again, traditionally, it was party political conferences, started primarily, Sussex owned it. There's a lot of people sort of wonder, how did Sussex get it? Well, if you go back far enough, the IRA blessed and blew up the Grand Hotel in Brighton. And because Sussex is a conference force, they were asked to develop this temporary HVM product alongside what was is now Naxo, what was CPNI, which is now NPSA, and the Home Office. And there was a lot of funding thrown in, and industry got involved as well. And the National Barrier Asset was formed, if you like, invented and developed. It took a long time, eventually becoming a lot of the heavy tartar steel products that you still use today. Very, very good kit. And I started getting involved with that alongside the search side of things, and eventually that became my full-time role, looking after the National Barrier Asset in 2018 after the attacks. It got taken into Naxo and the National Vehicle Threat Mitigation Unit was formed. And yeah, that was, as I say, that was my full-time job for probably 7 or 8 years within policing, just dealing with major HVM deployments around the UK. And we did a lot of work in the Netherlands as well, helping them develop their own response. So that was kind of where I came from.
Fantastic. And just for the benefit of our listeners, for those who maybe don't understand HVM, obviously that's referring to hostile vehicle mitigations. And I know certainly from my experience with some of the major events that we had in London when I was involved in policing, we used the National Barrier Asset for a lot of things there. And again, just to clarify a little bit for our listeners, the National Barrier Asset, and correct me if I'm wrong, Russ, is this kind of stockpile of a variety of different physical vehicle mitigations that we can use for events that may take place, temporary physical protection of locations and things of that nature.
That's right. Yeah, that's essentially it. It's a lot of kit that generally weighs quite a bit, is transferred on the back of large lorries and delivered using heavy plant and machinery to locations around the UK where that mitigation is required. And we'll talk more about what that provides as the podcast goes on. But yeah, that's the National Barrier Asset to a T. It's about, I think at the current prices, it's about £12 to £15 million worth of kit that is held in a location in the UK and deployed by a contractor wherever UK policing or UK government decides it's required. Yeah, it's quite a lot of good, high-quality kit.
Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that with us. And it's really interesting, actually, because it directly relates to the topic that we're going to be talking about. So as per the introduction, our discussion point for us today, I wanted to address the recent conviction on the 5th of February of a 16-year-old boy within the UK who was convicted for terrorism offences. Just to give our listeners a bit of context around this particular incident, so according to details that have been released during his trial, the boy, who hasn't been named, had developed a Islamic extremist mindset in late 2021, and then in June 2022, started online research focused on the Isle of Wight Music Festival, which is a large festival that takes place on an island called the Isle of Wight, just off the south coast of the UK. Whilst conducting this research, the investigation identified that he had searched the internet for various phrases, including gun and Isle of Wight, fast lorry, how many people are going to the Isle of Wight Festival, Isle of Wight Festival Gate, and Isle of Wight Festival Gate names. The trial also revealed that he discussed his plan to attack the festival with others online, which ultimately led to his arrest on the 11th of July 2022. And as I mentioned, we recently had his trial where he was convicted on the 5th of February this year. So the investigation also established that he had been radicalised by propaganda affiliated with the so-called Islamic State group. In addition to his attack planning, he was convicted for dissemination of terrorist publications online as well. So this is quite an interesting case, an example for us to consider, especially in light of your expertise, Russ, when thinking about the terrorist threat towards events and the type of attack methodologies that might be used against events and specifically open air events. I know from our work here at Terrascope that crowded open air events have previously been encouraged within extremist propaganda as particularly desirable targets. So my first question for you is, what is your perspective of the current potential terrorist threat towards open air events, and how has this threat developed in recent years?
I think, like you say, the focus moving away from VIPs, emergency services, military, which it was historically back in the day, to the Islamic threat, where essentially it's anybody is a fair target, that brings all these crowded places into scope for them. They can, you know, kill, maim, whatever they like, whoever they like. And as far as they're concerned, as long as they manage to do that, then they succeed. Their aim is achieved. That was, again, a real turning point. You look at something like Nice, the attack on the event in Nice on Bastille Day in 2016, and that was a real game-changing moment, as I'm sure many of the listeners will understand. And that, I really keep Nice in my mind a lot. I, as a risk manager in events, you have to consider everything. Now, again, back in the day, it was very much about IEDs. Let's try and cause mass disruption, blowing things up, or mortars and that sort of thing. The Irish threat was very different. Sadly, now anyone with a knife can cause a run amok, and that's what's made things so much harder. That threat has changed and manifested itself. Thankfully, firearms in the UK are still really quite hard to get hold of. Explosives are very, very hard to get hold of. Easy to make if you believe what people say online. I don't necessarily agree with that, because there's controls and checks and measures in place. It's not as easy as people think. Not helped by things like the television, and I'm talking about dramas more than anything. There's, if you believe what's online at the moment, everyone's blowing everybody up. Drones are coming in and shooting up the world. It's like, and that frustrates me a little bit. I'll go to event people who run events, event owners and producers, and they go, what about this threat? What about that threat? And you go, but you're taking your intelligence, if you like, from Hollywood, and the actual threat's not really like that. If we focused more on what the real threat is, which is knives and blunt instruments and vehicles, they're easy to get hold of rather than these sharks with the lasers that people think are really out there. So that's kind of my views on it. We need to focus people on what the real threat is, not what their perception of threat is.
Absolutely. And when we, again, looking at propaganda that's released by extremist groups, most predominantly the Islamist extremist related terrorist groups, but also looking at incidents that have happened, like you've already mentioned Nice, that was a bit of a catalyst for this particular focus of using vehicles as a weapon to conduct attack. And we've seen several incidents since then, both here within the UK and in other Western countries, where, again, a vehicle has been used as a physical weapon to maim and kill people by running them over. And I think, summarising the key point you've made there, is really this idea that, yes, traditionally, when we think about terrorism, it's synonymous with explosive devices, IEDs and things of that nature, which still pose a potential threat to us. And we do need to consider that, but in balance to the other attack methodologies we're seeing as well. So it's interesting about this whole concept of using a vehicle as a weapon. Relating it back to the plot we've mentioned, this young lad who had obviously radicalised seemingly online and then got to the point where he became mobilised and actually wanted to conduct an attack and was looking at the Isle of Wight Music Festival as his potential target. We can see from his online searches that he was clearly considering using a vehicle as a weapon, because within his search history, he had gone on there and was searching for fast lorries. So as a renowned subject matter expert in hostile vehicle mitigation, what are the options that are available to mitigate that sort of vehicle threat towards an event?
Yeah, it's an interesting subject matter expert. I love that. I don't know who said that. It's one of those expressions, and it always subject matter expert. I've got some experience in it. I've got quite a lot of experience in it. SME, I don't know. I try not to say that. Expert is just putting yourself up there to be shot down. So I'm going to say I've got a lot of experience in it. What's out there to mitigate? I think if I can get one thing across to your listeners today, the one thing I really need people to understand with their hostile vehicle mitigation is it's a plan that will give you time. And all that time does is gives you time to respond and react. And that's really, really key. And I'll clarify what I mean, because this is a great opportunity for people to get their heads around, particularly in the temporary space, what I'm talking about. Now, if I create for you using a set of tested and rated products, and we'll talk about that a bit later, I get you what people love to call a ring of steel, and I hate that term as well, but we can all visualize what I'm talking about when I talk about a ring of steel. So I've put rated measures 150 meters around your event, your main area you're trying to protect. Do people genuinely think that the terrorist is going to see those rated measures and go, oh, do you know what? You've stopped me. I'm going to turn around. I'm going to drive home. I'm going to have a cup of tea. They're not going to think that at all. What you got there is 150 meters of standoff or delay or whatever you want to call it. And in a very binary way, let's pretend that the terrorist had driven up to your measures and stopped. And they're 150 metres from wherever it is you're looking to protect. Now, I'm a fit young man in my 50s, and I can run 150 metres in on a good day, probably 30 seconds. Now, I've therefore bought you 30 seconds of delay. Let's say I've bought you 30 seconds of delay. Now, if my plan doesn't include 30 seconds worth of response, so by that I mean I need my stewards to start moving people away. I need my public to react. I need people to understand that bad stuff is happening. I might as well have just put daisy chains out. If there's no plan behind my measures, I've failed, because that terrorist isn't going home for a cup of tea. They're getting out. They're going to start stabbing. They're going to start shooting. They're going to start clubbing. They're going to start doing what they do. And counterterrorism really is very much about, or protective security is very much about, stopping people being injured or worse. And again, it's really, really binary. It's not sexy. It's if there's no one there to kill, they don't get killed. Run, hide, tell. Fantastic. But do it. And by do it, I mean that plan has to incorporate recognition that something's going on. And once you've recognized that, that steward, that security person in the high vis needs to act. They need to call in on their radio saying, I've got an attack. They need to sound an air horn, start shouting, start moving people away from the threat. If they've not been told what to do when that happens, how can you or I or the risk owner stand up in front of a magistrate or worse, a coroner, and say, they didn't do what I wanted them to do when you haven't told them what to do? Now, I'll take that back again. And spoiler alert, when I do presentations on this, one of the slides I put up right at the beginning is a picture of an elephant. And I say to people, right, if there's an elephant comes into the room, back of the room, we all go out through the window. And they look at me as if to say, you're a bit mad. And I go, elephant attack, comes in through the back, we go out the window. I said, I need you all to point to the window. And they're like, so they do it. They humour me. We go further, halfway through the presentation, I talk about methods of attack and IEDs and guns and knives and things and elephants. I say, what do we do if an elephant comes in the back? And they go, we go out the window. I say, that's brilliant. Well done, everybody. The final slide is a picture of a man dressed as an elephant. I say, what are we doing? They go, we're going out the window. I said, that's brilliant. I said, is it an elephant or is it a man dressed as an elephant? Is it a terrorist attack? Is it a road crash? Is it a domestic? Is it a fight? I said, we don't know, but it looks like a terrorist attack. It looks like an elephant. So I know that we've got to go out the window. I said, that is the essence of your HVM plan. I said, I've told you. I said, I can stand in front of a coroner and say, I told you if the elephants come in the back, we go out the window. And you see this little light bulb come on over people's heads. And I go, that's also the essence of part of Martin's law that's coming, the protect duty, whatever you want to call it. A lot of it is just about training. It's about awareness. It's tell people what you expect them to do. And then they may actually do it when the bad stuff happens. And that's essentially a hostile vehicle mitigation plan. As I say, you want a response or a reaction. A response, you want your police, you want your security service running towards to neutralize the threat. We all know what that means. They're going to take out the bad guys. We want a reaction from the public. Run away. There's no suggestion that a steward in a high-vis jacket is going to take on a knife-wielding maniac. No suggestion of that at all. But what they can do is call it in on the radio and get everybody else out of the way. Simple. And that was never made more clear to me. I say, go back to 2016. There was a video that I saw of the Nice attack. And it's not a nice video. You see people dancing in front of a stage and there's a stage they're dancing and you see the lorry plough through the background. Now, the truth is that lorry was a kilometre and a half into its attack. If there'd been a plan, what would have happened was that music would have been turned off. The DJ would have said, can we all move on to the beach? And jobs are good and those people are still alive. But there was no plan. And that's the point. A plan doesn't have to cost a huge amount of money. A plan just has to be written down and briefed out to people. If someone in a lorry comes in a kilometre and a half away, 90 seconds away, you've got time to collect your belongings, you know, finish your beer and get on the beach, but you're still alive. But there was no plan. And that was where I started getting really quite passionate about there has to be something beyond these barriers. There's got to be some really simple, really cheap planning goes into place. And it's all represented and replicated by the MPSA. You look on the MPSA website, what is hostile vehicle mitigation? It's measures and processes. It's not just measures. There has to be the process behind it. Otherwise, it falls over very, very quickly. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I couldn't agree more. I think it's a theme that has come up so many times with other people that we've spoken to on this podcast. You know, the starting point and at the heart of any kind of protective security measure, whether it be for the terrorism threat or any other kind of security threat that your location or people might be facing, is that, yes, there is lots of, you know, physical mitigations we can do. There's lots of technology potentially that you can buy depending on what you're trying to address. But ultimately, it all comes down to what is your response plan? What are you going to do? And not only having a response plan on what you're going to do, but rehearsing that as well, having it practiced so that everyone knows what is expected of them. And I'm sure for many of our listeners and for some people I've spoken to about this topic previously, it sounds like common sense. However, unfortunately, it's one of those things with all of the pressures that businesses or security providers face, And also potentially issues in terms of, especially with temporary events where you are hiring in stewards and things of that nature, marshals that maybe are just being hired in for that sort of an event. It's something that, that can be easily overlooked. And quite often it's the sort of analogy I take from that sort of protective security is that on a slightly different topic, you could spend millions of pounds protecting a particular location with alarm systems, CCTV, access point control, and all of these things, depending on the circumstances, are very legitimate and worthwhile things to think about and consider. However, if your member of staff uses the fire exit to have a cigarette and props the back door open every day at lunchtime with that fire extinguisher, you've just undermined all of that money you've spent, all of that protective security, all of that response plan. But by simply briefing and making your staff consistently aware of these are the expectations of you, i.e. you do not exit by the fire exit unless there's a fire, go by the main front door, or if you ever do go out the fire exit, certainly don't prop it open, because it just undermines everything that you've done. And quite interestingly, you mentioned there this concept of the ring of steel, and it's certainly one I've come across quite frequently. So when people do think about hostile vehicle mitigations, they normally straight away they start thinking about big barriers like we see around airports and things of that nature, or if you go around some sensitive locations or pretty much any location in London, you see lovely silver bollards that are permanently fixed into the ground around a location and things like that. But obviously that sort of vehicle mitigation isn't suitable for your temporary event, like with the Isle of Wight Music Festival or some of the other events that you've been kind of involved with. So considering that permanent fixed mitigation isn't feasible in that sort of situation, what sort of HVM, hostile vehicle mitigation, options are open to events? Are there things that can be used that are temporary rather than permanently fixed?
Absolutely, 100%. Just to go back and back up what you were saying and just add a bit more on that, the security guard who's propping up the fire door with the fire extinguisher, something I've learned quite recently, actually, is don't just tell them not to do it. Tell them why. And it's something that really, really was brought into focus with me in the last 12 months was I was doing some sort of penetration testing. It wasn't a proper test. It was just I kept getting something into this event that I was working on. And in the end, I said, do you understand why this particular item isn't allowed in there? And they said, nope. I said, right, let me explain it to you. And these people suddenly were like, now we get it. Now we understand the threat that that particular item has, because it was to do with an ongoing issue. And again, when you're talking about events, you've got to understand that you're, with the best will in the world, the staff you employ, they're not, their influences aren't, you know, BBC News, Sky News. They're not up to date on current attacks or politics or anything like that. Their influences are TikTok and YouTube and all the rest of it, and fake news, for want of a better word, sometimes, if they're bothered about the news at all. But actually, that why can't someone take that in there? And you suddenly get this massive buy-in from people when you take the extra couple of minutes and go, that's why. They go, okay, now I get it. Far more likely to spot that item if they understand the use of it. Anyway, sorry, I went back. We'll go forward. Mitigation for events. There is. In the last few years, there's been a real upsurge, certainly since around about 2017, just before then, if I'm brutally honest, in lightweight products. I talk about the National Barrier Asset. Now, each part of that weighs about 3 tons and is very, very needy is kind of a word I like to use. You bring it in on a big lorry, you need a big forklift to remove it about, but it's very, very effective. It's categorically the top end of the products that's around. It will, you know, if you crash your vehicle into it using a penetrative attack methodology at high speed, it's going to hold it. It will stop. Now, again, I don't want to go into the realms of risk mitigation completely, but obviously predictability is one of the sort of mitigations we think about, or one of the parts that we consider is how predictable is this event, how predictable is the mitigations. And you now look at, can I put something down that's more lightweight, easier to move, cheaper? And cost is a massive factor for everyone, You know, we can't ignore the fact that cost is a factor. So this lightweight kit came into being, and lots of quite a few companies started producing lighter weight kit. Now there is a place for this. There's lots of different methods, and I know we'll cover different testing regimes, but the National Protective Security Authority, who have their catalogue of approved product for hostile vehicle mitigation, they have two kinds of standards. They have an impact rated standard and a delay rated standard. And the impact rated is will a vehicle, the inputs are vehicle mass, vehicle speed, and vehicle direction. The output is how far past your measure does that go. There's a delay standard, and I don't want to go into the specifics of what that standard is, but that counts time. How much time do I get to move my victims, potential victims, out of the way? The lighter weight, the event-based kit, sits within the VADS, the Vehicle Access Delay Standard. That sits in there, and this is working on a different means of mitigating the threat. So it's a different attack methodology, but there's a lightweight kit out there. CrowdGuard, you mentioned I work with CrowdGuard. We have loads of this kit, lots of different types of kit, because one size doesn't fit all. And again, please, listeners, do not think one size fits all. It doesn't. There's got to be a different, it's horses for courses every time. And that operational requirement, do I need to get a vehicle past it? How pedestrian permeable does it need to be? Can I put something down and walk away from it? Is the point where it's going to be deployed, is a member of staff with it? All these things you need to consider. But there is a decent range now of lightweight, affordable kit that can be literally brought in the back of a pickup truck or on the back of a trailer, dropped out by one person and brought in again at the end of the day. It's leaps and bounds ahead of where we were certainly 5 or 6 years ago.
Fantastic. It's good to know that obviously there's been quite a bit of innovation in trying to produce HVM products that are specifically get over these challenges around temporary sort of events that can still provide a level of appropriate protection around them to keep people safe. So you mentioned there and mentioned previously about rating. And this is something that actually one of our listeners has written into us about, because they have confusion as to, they work within security, but they have confusion as to what does rating mean? A bollard's a bollard, isn't it? A barrier's a barrier. So would you mind just explaining a little bit more and expand a little bit more on ratings? And are they UK ratings or are they global ratings?
No, I don't want to confuse the audience too much. However, they'll have all heard about PAS 68 and IWA 14.1. And there's a new kid on the block, the ISO 22343-1:22/2023, the new rating. So PAS, Publicly Accessible Standard, PAS 68. Was the first iteration of a standard, IWA 14.1, International Workshop Agreement 14.1. These are standards we're used to hearing about. And what they basically measure, these are what I refer to as impact standards. So it tends to be your permanent or semi-permanent kit tends to carry these ratings. There's a reason for that, is it's expensive to get the testing done. It's all done by MPSA and certain companies will test. As I said before, the input, if you like, and call it, we simply say input and output. The input is a certain weight, a certain shape, a certain type of vehicle is thrown, if you like, at a known speed, a known velocity, 30 mile an hour, 40 mile an hour, 50 mile an hour, at this measure. So we've got all those controllable variables. The output of that, if you like, is how far past the measure did the vehicle end up? And there's other little bits like, was there a large fly-off of certain parts, depending on which test standard you use. But ultimately, the aim is we throw a lorry at it or a car or a pickup truck at a certain known controlled speed. The output is, did the measure hold the vehicle? Did it go beyond it? And that's where your string of characters, and I really don't want to go into what that string of characters looks like. It will blow people's minds. Look on the PSSA website, look on the NPSA website, the Perimeter Security Suppliers Association, HVM Hub. They have a really good guide on this is what testing standards look like. The new kid on the block, ISO 22343, is trying to combine them into a global standard. You also have the ASTM standard, which is an American standard using American-shaped vehicles. The ISO is trying to standardize all of that so that it's a global standard. Don't forget, you have PAS 68 and PAS 69. You have IWA 14.1 and IWA 14.2. The second part of those standards is the installation of the product. So you have the product itself has to be correct. It then has to be installed as per the manufacturer's guidelines, which forms part of the 69 and the 14.2. However, on top of that, it has to be maintained as well, or the rating is removed. So you've got to put it in properly and keep it maintained, and then you keep your rating. So that's a little bit, as I say, that's your impact rating. And if you go on the MPSA catalogue, impact rated, that's what they're doing. Large vehicle or small vehicle, depending on what the test is, into the product, output is, did it restrain the vehicle? How far beyond the line, the data line, did it go? Again, that's very, very basic. The scientists and boffins will tell you more. I could tell you more. I don't want to blow people's minds. The other standard, the vehicle access delay standard, is more aimed at the temporary market, the event market. It is more the delay standard. And have a look at that. And as I say, at CrowdGob, we've got a load of products, all VADS rated or PAS IWA rated. Lots of products straddle both because they want to have the impact rating and the delay standard. So, but I would never recommend anything that doesn't have a rating. It's not in the catalogue. Don't use it.
And it's interesting because essentially, yes, it can get complicated with all of these different ratings. They're trying to get to a global standardization to make it clearer and easier. But for the purpose of our listeners, it's kind of, if you are going to have HVM, you've got to get the right stuff that you know is going to work, that's been rated, it's been installed correctly. In that sort of regard, a lot of the time, again, going back to that sort of visualization of a ring of steel, sometimes it could be an event or it could be a permanent location, that there's this kind of adverse attitude to having hostile vehicle mitigation put in because of aesthetically how it looks. They want their location to be quite welcoming. They want it to be a place where people feel safe, and they don't particularly want their security to be overt because they feel it might dampen the atmosphere that they're trying to uphold and achieve. So are there ways to still use and put in physical hostile vehicle mitigation at location without it necessarily being overt and kind of influencing the aesthetics around that particular location?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best form of hostile vehicle mitigation is complete separation of vehicles from people. That's a given. That's HVM lesson one, is if vehicles and pedestrians are kept apart, great, nobody gets run over. Bear in mind, there's 7 types of vehicle attack that have been carried out. Do not forget the vehicle-borne IED is still a possibility. We haven't completely got rid of it. It's just different terrorists, different motivations. You still have to consider standoff. You still have to consider the IED threat. But if we're talking purely vehicle as a weapon, purely the I'm going to use the vehicle to run people over, separation of vehicles from people is your optimum aim. Now, there are things you can do to make your event less vulnerable, and there's things you can consider. It's something we used to talk about, tactical parking, where on an approach to a road, everybody, when you're running an event, they go, oh, I want to suspend the parking. And you go, well, do you want to suspend the parking? Yeah, I want a really clear road. And you think, well, if you suspend the parking, that gives you a clear road, but it also means that that's a nice clear road for an attacker. Actually, why don't you not suspend the parking? And there's a number of places where you have large open parks, for instance. And you go, actually, if you've parked vehicles all the way around the outside of your park, and the only way you can get a vehicle on is to move those out of the way, well, it's not a rated measure by any stretch, but it's going to give me a little bit of assurance that you can't get a vehicle on. And please don't take this as me saying, park vehicles up, they work for everything. Something that's really, really key is if you're going to do things, and I totally accept that people will try and put things in and say, well, I'm doing something and something's better than nothing, and I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. But as long as you understand what your measure or what your proposed measure won't do. And I was once famously quoted as saying you can use hay bales as HVM. And I'm like, I think I know where that was, but I've been totally taken out of context. What I'm talking about there is if you've got four lanes of traffic towards an event and you use hay bales and signage to take four lanes down to one lane, what you've done there is you've clogged the road. You've absolutely taken any opportunity to build speed up by clogging that road with compliant traffic. So what was a 50 mile an hour road becomes a traffic jam because you've put nothing in but some hay bales. As I say, I've completely taken out of context, but you can control these things. There are things you can do to make the event safer on the understanding that actually you could influence the traffic lights. You could influence, you could hold the traffic up with your vehicle and create a run up for yourself. But as long as you understand that those are the limitations of your plan, so be it. Going back to your initial point, can it look pretty? Not really. You know, measures are measures. And again, I remember having a conversation, quite a funny conversation actually, with someone who insisted that their inflatable arch went in the same location as my national barrier asset. And in the end, I just said, it either goes there or you can't have it. I'm not really interested in your inflatable arch. You've asked us to come down here. It's one of those things. It will be what it will be. But I would urge that people think about creating as much standoff as possible. And if you put your traffic restrictions in far enough out, it shouldn't impact on the look and feel of the event because you're giving yourself that space. That's the thing I try and encourage people is if you think we only need to go back one street, you probably need to go back two. And that's where you start putting your measures so that as people approach the event, they're not even cognizant that the measures are there doing what they're doing. So that's one of the keys is, and you know, there's a product like Surface Guard. It's a rated product. It's impact rated, it's delay rated. You can walk through it. You can drive through it at certain locations. People expect it these days. And a lot of the time people come back and say, where's your measures? I haven't been busy or anything. And either we've done it really well and disguised them because they look okay. And we, you know, there's branding opportunities and marketing and that sort of thing. If people just go through them and don't know they're there, that's great. And as I say, sometimes you get, why haven't you got any HVM? You go, we have, you haven't seen it. And that's great. And that's an option. But yeah, standoff's really important still. And yeah, I think the key is people need to understand it's more of, you've got to understand how the event's going to work to really make it work. Again, when I first started working for CrowdGuard, they got a little bit fed up with me because the first two events I did, I took my experience with me and cut the measures. They were over-specking it. And I'm like, don't need that. It's doing nothing. And they sort of said, you're kind of doing this in the wallet here, Russ. I'm like, I don't care. It's not, this isn't what it's about. It's about doing it properly. And both the schemes have been designed by people who had no idea what they were doing. And I'm like, not CrowdGuard. It was other people just said, put it in and they put it in. I'm like, not doing anything. So we now absolutely make sure that everything is appropriate and correct for people.
Fantastic. And I know that we'll probably have listeners, many, many listeners who work within security or work within counterterrorism. They may be responsible for making decisions around security for events, but they're not expected to all be hostile vehicle mitigation experts, know all of the ratings, know all of the sort of understand what sort of speeds vehicles could maybe get up to on the roads around their events and things like that, and what sort of rating would be beneficial. So for those people, what sort of resources or services are available for them if they are responsible for writing a threat assessment or a risk assessment for a particular event or for having that responsibility on their shoulders? What can they kind of do proactively then to understand a bit more about what they should be considering or maybe what would be appropriate to have in place around their particular event?
I think the key, there's a couple of points to that. The first is have a look at the MPSA catalogue. It's open source. You can just MPSA catalogue of security equipment. In there is a whole list of products that are rated by them and they've been tested to whatever standard and the test standards are listed. Again, there's no expectation that you would know what that looks like and what to expect from that. I think it's really key to understand if you are considering HVM, it's not just barriers. It's a plan. You've got to think about if I had, and I hate the expression, it's a vehicle attack. It's a knife attack. I actually prefer it's a terrorist attack, because it's the chances of it being only one attack type are very, very slim. It will be started, the vehicle part of it will likely be the start of the attack, as we saw in 2017 in London and in the Paris attacks. The vehicle's part of it is the start, and a vehicle attack will deliver attackers or explosives, or will be used as the vehicle itself as part of the attack. It doesn't stop. So people need to get out of their heads that it's that. It's not just going to stop. So it's the plan has to sit behind it. The HVM is part of their counterterrorism plan, but only part of it. It's not, I'm going to put a ring of steel up and we're all golden. Not at all. You need to be thinking about, you know, the person who's going to just walk up with just a knife in the down the back of their trousers. So are you looking at behavioral detection? Are you looking at search arches or the new mass search screening that's going in? All of this needs to be in your plan. But from an HVM perspective, you know, again, I can do vehicle dynamics assessments. I can tell you exactly how fast a vehicle will go. Talk to your CTSAs, you know, again, and talk to your SECOs. The police are out there. If your event's big enough, the chances are the police will be involved. If they're not, reach out to a company that provides hostile vehicle mitigation, but understands that it's a counter-terrorism product, not a parking assistance. My concern at the moment when I look at the market is there are companies out there that will hire you a few racks of an HVM product to go, there you go, do it yourself. And you go, you're kind of putting that out as if it's a set of cones and signs, which it isn't. You really, really need to understand what it is you're doing, because it's all well and good taking the money until the bad stuff happens. And then, like you say, have you done a risk assessment? Have you done a threat and vulnerability assessment? Which a CrowdGuard will do all of that, but we'll talk you through it. We'll hold your hand through it. Really need people to not. And again, the expression I use is, if I'm running an event, do I go to the bloke who does the toilets to do my stage lighting? I don't. So why do I go to the bloke who does the car parking to do my counter-terrorism? And that's the point I try and make with people. It's like HVM is a counter-terrorism product, not a traffic management product. And if you don't understand that, we've got a bit of an issue. Just because someone's going to rent you some barriers out doesn't mean you're covered. You're probably not, because you've acknowledged there's a threat there, and you've not really countered it with anything apart from you've hired some stuff in without really understanding what that stuff does. And I think that worries me a bit.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point to make, actually. And as we're starting to progressively, no one knows when it's going to happen, but progressively move towards, as you've mentioned here in the UK, Martin's Law and the Protect Duty, which we have discussed in a previous podcast episode. But essentially, if that all comes to fruition, it will put this legal responsibility, certainly on large events, will be included in that, I'm sure, that they have to consider these things and have to be putting the right measures and things in place. So it really is a case of, I think one of the key points you're making there is do your threat and risk assessments, identify what you need, work with professionals in order to do that and understand what you need and what is going to be proportionate and effective for what you need. And it may not mean spending, you know, thousands of pounds, but certainly in the UK, there is going to be this expectation, if there isn't a moral one already, that these things have been considered and have been done. And ultimately, hopefully it never happens for any of our listeners or anyone else, but we do know it's a case of when, not if, the next attack will take place. And if that is an event that you may be, as a security practitioner, have responsibility for, you want to be in the position post that incident where you can sit there and say, we did everything we could have done and we did it correctly. You don't want to be there as that person that made that decision to, oh yeah, we'll just use those, as you say, parking barriers as our HVM, try to go for that protection through perception rather than protection through actual things that are tried and tested. and then kind of have to live with that decision and think, if I'd only just put the right barriers in, if they'd been rated, then actually maybe X, Y, and Z wouldn't have happened. Russ, thank you very much for joining us today and freely giving us your time. As a token of our appreciation, we'd like to make a donation to a charity on your behalf because you have given your time up freely for us today. So is there a charity that you'd like to mention or that you are particularly passionate about that you'd like us to make a donation to on your behalf?
Actually, the charity that if I'm going to give a plug to, and it's Rap Aid. It's the Rap Aid Bandages. Real believer in, and we talk about consequence and we talk about impact. And actually, they're one of those organisations where we go back to Manchester and we talk about people didn't get the medical attention they needed. I'm also a big advocate around helping people. And knife crime at the moment is horrendous in the UK. And Rap Aid are putting bandage packs, bleed kits into taxis all over the UK and all of that. So what I would ask is, do you know what? Just get hold of one Rap Aid pack and donate it somewhere. That would work for me. That'd be great. Just get one of those, donate it somewhere and go. Because you know what? Somebody could just use that and need that. And that'd be great. Thank you.
No problem at all. That's great. And it'd be our pleasure to do that. So thank you again for joining us. And for all our listeners, make sure to tap the like button and follow us on whichever podcast platform you use to make sure that you stay informed of all our future episodes. If you would like to contact a member of the Terrascope team or Russ, our guest speaker today, you can find our contact details in the description for this episode. So thank you once again for listening. And until our next episode, please stay safe.